Coming up is the news.
Thousands rally in the Yemeni city of Sada to condemn a U.S. move to blacklist the Ansarallah movement. A Russian vessel involved in the construction of Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline begins its work in Danish waters despite a threat of sanctions by the U.S. And the White House saying that a travel ban on most non-U.S. citizens will be reinstated. That's while the number of COVID cases in that country exceeds 25 million. It's a great pleasure to have you with us. Let's start with Yemen. Thousands of people there have taken to the streets in the city of Sada in order to slam a U.S. decision to blacklist the Ansarallah movement. The demonstrators are calling on the American authorities to reverse the decision. Former U.S. President Donald Trump designated the group as a terrorist organization during the final days of his administration. Will that trigger protests from the United Nations and international aid groups? UN officials say that it will further complicate efforts to combat the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Iranian foreign minister says that Tehran has always welcomed dialogue with Persian Gulf states. Mohammad Javad Zarif says the regional countries need to cooperate with each other and adopt confidence-building measures. He made those comments upon arrival in the Azeri capital, Baku, on the first leg of his regional tour of the Caucasus. The comments came after Saudi Arabia's foreign minister, Faisal bin Farhan, claimed that a kingdom has extended its hand to Iran for peace, but that Tehran does not commit. A political commentator, Joe Lombardo, says that the reason Saudi Arabia and some of its Arab allies are establishing warmer ties with Israel are to form a stronger front against Iran.
You know, I know there had been some conflict between Saudi Arabia and some of its allies and Qatar, because they had better relationships with Iran, and now they seem to have mended those to some extent. But it also comes on the heels of the agreements that they are making under the misleadership of the Trump administration and the United States with Israel, which many of us consider a stab in the back of the Palestinians. So I don't really know if this is the reason or it's an attempt to try to gain a stronger alliance against Iran, but in any case, what is needed is cooperation between all of the countries in the region.
Now, Tehran has stressed that it will not change its stance regarding the 2015 nuclear deal unless witnessing the effective implementation of the deal by other signatories. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh says Tehran has not seen any developments regarding the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. He underlined that Iran wants all the sanctions removed. The spokesman says Iran will reverse the measures it has taken to scale down its commitments only after the other parties fulfill their obligations. He urged the new U.S. government to act if it wants to correct the mistakes of the previous administration. Now, we had this news of Yemeni people taking to the streets of the city of Sada to slam a U.S. decision to blacklist the Ansarallah movement there. Now, from the Yemeni capital, Sana'a, I'm now joined by Hussein Al-Bukhaiti. He's an activist and political commentator. Hussein, tell us what's going on in Yemeni cities today and also what the Yemeni people are demanding.
Today, millions of Yemeni people will take up to the street in a huge gathering. In some cities like in Sada, it took place this morning, and in Sana'a there will be a huge gathering today in the afternoon. And the title of those protest and gathering, that the war and blockade in Yemen is a terrorist act. This came weeks after the United States has designated the Houthis as a terrorist group, and Yemenis here, and a Houthi is a huge part of Yemenis, and they are the one who are leading the Yemeni forces to protect Yemen and to attack as well Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates and all those countries who are involved in the war on Yemen. That's why we've seen that this today protest is show a huge support for Ansarullah, also known as the Houthi, and for their leadership, who actually are committed to fight for Yemen, to protect Yemen, and as well to fight for all Muslim causes. The war on Yemen was launched 6 years ago because of after the revolution in Yemen in 21st of September 2014, which has denounced the U.S. Foreign policy in Yemen, and as well denounced the occupation of Palestine. That's why this war actually was started and was launched by Saudi Arabia. It's exactly the same story after the revolution, the Islamic revolution in Iran. We've seen that Iraq has started the war with the same coalition, with the same coalition that's now launching the war on Yemen, with the same support from United States, UK, France, and other countries. Because what's important for the United States, that all countries in the region, they should stay silent about the crime that's done by the United States and by the Zionist state against Palestine and against all other Muslim region. And that's why this revolution in Yemen, and as well the Islamic revolution in Iran, has caused a huge damage for the United States and the Zionist state foreign policy in the region. And this latest designation, people in Yemen here think of it as an honor for Yemenis, because it shows the exact aggression against Yemen is from the United States. I mean, United States, actually, it doesn't matter if you commit all kind of crime, as long as you are loyal to them, like Saudi regime and United Arab regime and other regime in the Persian Gulf, they are happy with that. But as long as you want to protect your country, fight your country, like now Yemeni do, like the Iraqis do, like the Syrian, and as well the Palestinian people and the Lebanese people do, this is actually, the United States doesn't like it. But I believe, and I'm sure, that this latest designation, and it will not affect Yemeni people. It will only shows other Yemenis who still actually doesn't believe that the war against Yemen is an American war. I think this latest designation show this exact point.
And Mr. Bukhati, you know that the United Nations and also some other international aid agencies, they are concerned, and they have also blamed the U.S. decision. So tell us what the situation is like there in terms of humanitarian aid being impacted by this recent designation.
I think from the existence of the United Nations, they always show concern about many issues and many wars that's launched by the United States. And but of course, this latest designation actually will affect many United Nations and other NGOs who are working on Yemen, because we have this blockade in Yemen, the closure of the airport, and only like every 2 or 3 months, few flights come to Sana'a with the food and medicine. And as well, Saudi Arabia, after 3 or 5 to 6 months of blocking ships to go into Yemen, sometimes they let some ships every now and then. But this latest designation actually will affect those international NGOs in Yemen work. It will affect the money transferred from outside to those NGOs in Sana'a or in other city. And I believe this was the main goal from this latest designation. Saudi Arabia, after they couldn't break the Yemeni people, they destroyed all port and airport. They want to make Yemeni suffer. They think that Yemenis are stupid, that we gonna blame, and me as Yemeni, we gonna blame the Houthi for this, for what's happening in Yemen. That's why this latest designation, it wants to step the pressure and the suffering of Yemeni people. But this latest protest, it shows that despite the fact Yemen is under blockade, as under constant attack for the last 6 wars, Yemeni are actually going to be united, and they will fight back. We have now here in Sana'a and other area, there is no fuel. The price of fuel has tripled because Saudi Arabia is not allowing fuel ship coming into Yemen. But I believe that now the full responsibility is in the hand of Sana'a government to fight back to Saudi. And I'm sure that Biden will not review this latest designation, because United States policy and foreign policy and security policy is always the same. The war started during Obama administration. Obama, who was given the Nobel Peace Prize, who started a dirty war on Syria, on Iraq, and on Libya. And now Trump As well on Yemen, it started during Obama administration, and Biden, he's called in the United States as Obama shadow. So he will continue to do the same. And I think what Biden should look to, Biden has lost his wife and his child in a car accident many years ago. So he knows how it felt to lose your loved one. But I should think the same for millions of Yemenis, for hundreds of thousands of Yemeni civilians who are killed by United States blockade, by support of Saudi Arabia, by all those weapon sales into Saudi Arabia. But it's going to be proven in the next days and next week that Biden is exactly the same as other presidents. But actually, Trump, I think he was one of the best American president because he was so clear, so honest, even though he was a bad president for our region. But at least he has shown that the United States has the greatest mercenary army. He said, we will protect you if you pay us, say that to Saudi Arabia and to other countries. He showed the exact face of the United States. And I think, and me personally, I should thank him for that, because during his 4 years terms as a U.S. president, he is the one who exposed
rights activists and political commentator in Sana'a, the Yemeni capital. Now, moving on to Russian pipeline has started working, and that a week after sanctions threat by the previous U.S. administration. And this is according to the company that owns the ship. It says the Fortuna is now engaged in building a corridor in the waters off Denmark ahead of resuming the Nord Stream construction. Several Russian support vessels are also set to be in the immediate vicinity. The 10 billion euro pipeline that will run beneath the Baltic Sea is to double Russian natural gas shipments to Germany. The pipeline that's more than 90% complete has long been a contentious issue for the U.S., especially under President Trump. Washington has imposed many rounds of sanctions on companies involved in the project, arguing it would increase Europe's reliance on Russian energy. U.S. President Joe Biden is planning to reinstate a coronavirus travel restriction on most non-U.S. citizens entering the country from Britain, Brazil, Ireland, and much of Europe. A White House official says that Biden will also extend a ban to travelers who've been to South America. The decision was made amid warnings that new, more transmissible corona variants are already establishing themselves in the states. Well, this just 1 week after former President Trump, in his final days in office, ordered the restrictions to be lifted. The United States is the world's hardest hit nation by the coronavirus. More than 25 million COVID-19 cases and also 420,000 deaths recorded in the country since the pandemic began. A correspondent in Washington, D.C., Colin Campbell, says that measures by the previous administration failed to curb the pandemic in the country.
The nation is still in a pattern of healing, and that is because there have been so many coronavirus cases over the past year and hundreds of thousands of deaths. We're still projected to hit 600,000 deaths before the virus is fully contained. And that's why the current president wants to still impose a ban on travel coming from other countries, because we're still a nation that has not had complete control over the virus. Although some states have a plateau in the number of new cases, when you look from coast to coast, there's still a number of cases in a number of states where the virus still hasn't been contained. And to introduce new people and new entrants into within our borders would just further increase the possibility that the virus would spread. And so that's why the president is now reimposing those travel restrictions. It almost seemed to defy logic for the previous president to lift those restrictions as we were still dealing with the pandemic. It was almost like he was in constant denial up until the point where he left office, and he might still be in denial. So the current president is trying to do, from what it seems like, the best he can to keep the virus under control, to keep the number of casualties, the number of deaths, lower than would be anticipated. And of course, that would include decreasing the amount of travelers coming from other countries into the United States, where the possibility of the spread of the virus could increase.
Now, in the Netherlands, police have arrested some 250 people amid violent and nationwide rallies against a curfew to curb the spread of COVID-19. Now, police used dogs and water cannon to disperse the ralliers in Amsterdam. In the southern city of Eindhoven, police fired tear gas to disperse a crowd of several hundred. Similar incidents were reported elsewhere, including in The Hague, Breda, and Arnhem. The curfew, which is the country's first since World War II, is set to last until February 10th. The Netherlands was already under its toughest measures since the start of the pandemic. New variants of the virus, particularly a more infectious strain that first emerged in Britain, have led to deep concerns in Europe. Now, in Portugal, the incumbent president says that his administration will prioritize the fight against the COVID-19 pandemic in that country after winning the Sunday presidential vote.
The main response given by this election is one and one alone. Everything begins with the battle against the pandemic. If the pandemic lasts and worsens, everything else we love will become worse, for longer, and be harder to face.
Sousa made those comments as his country is experiencing a surge in infections with record-high daily fatalities. He gained 61% of the vote in the presidential race, his major challenger won over 13%. The election was marked by record abstention. More than 60% of the eligible people refused to vote, and that's the highest figure in Portuguese history. A debate in the European Parliament hears the social crisis in the EU resulting from COVID-19 will likely persist for many years. The governments in the bloc are being urged to speed up the release of funding to support the most vulnerable. Jerome Hughes has a report.
The number of people sleeping on the streets at night across the European Union is growing by the day amid the pandemic. Welfare systems are under enormous strain. We have been speaking to one homeless man in Brussels who is finding it difficult to acquire emergency accommodation.
It's very hard in the cold, in the winter. It's very hard to feel good, to find somewhere. It's very difficult.
A debate on the worsening social crisis in the EU resulting from COVID-19 has been held in the European Parliament.
We have a problem here. The slow, sluggish bureaucracy of the European Union is not compatible with emergencies like the one we face today.
Governments in the EU are being urged to submit pandemic recovery plans to the European Commission so that €750 billion in available funding can be released without any further delay.
Millions of people lost already their jobs, and they are mainly the low-skilled, the low-paid workers, the temporary workers, the young on precarious work.
The European Parliament debate was told the EU social crisis could last for many years unless action is taken to save economies.
Thousands of businesses have temporarily or permanently closed. Millions of Europeans have lost their jobs and livelihoods.
Many EU legislators say the 27-country bloc's vaccination programme is being delivered too slowly. To make matters worse, experts in the UK are suggesting the new variant of COVID-19, discovered last year in England, might be more deadly than previously thought.
EU officials are concerned new variants of the disease might be resistant to approved vaccines and vaccines awaiting approval. With that comes obvious health concerns, but also incredible economic uncertainty. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A Japanese Prime Minister Yoshihide Suga is under pressure for his handling of the coronavirus pandemic. An opinion poll indicates support for Suga's cabinet has dropped to 33% from 39% last month. 80% of the respondents believe that the government was too slow to declare a state of emergency to tackle the pandemic. Opposition lawmakers have criticized Suga for his style of leadership. They demand the Prime Minister provide detailed answers to questions about a pandemic crisis and the Tokyo Olympics set to start in less than 6 months. Japan has registered 365,000 COVID cases and more than 5,100 deaths. Military sources say that Indian and Chinese troops have brawled again in the Himalayan contested border region. The clash between the troops took place last week at the Nakula Pass region. Sources have quoted Indian military officials as saying that there were casualties on both sides. And that's happening as India and China held the 9th round of talks over the dispute at the Ladakh region on Sunday. Beijing and New Delhi have long been at odds over the demarcation of borders. Tensions began to rise last June after the killing of 20 Indian soldiers. Sporadic clashes have taken place instead, with diplomatic attempts making little progress.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. My country, Iran, is a vast land with four seasons. The four-season feature in Iran brings about the experience of winter tourism in one place and summer tourism in another at the same time. For example, rain, wavy seas, storm, beautiful rivers, desert, all and all are available in just one land. Today we are going to visit northwest of Iran to see one of the wonders of this region, the Takht-e-Suleyman Lake of Takab. Takht-e-Suleyman, meaning Throne of Solomon, is an archaeological site in West Azerbaijan province, which used to be known as Ganjak very long time ago. Today this region is called Takht-e-Suleyman. Takht-e-Suleyman site is 45 kilometers northeast of the city of Takab. The ancient area of Takht-e-Suleyman includes Sassanid and Ilkhanid gates, Azargoshasp fire temple, and Anahita temple. At the center of this archaeological site, there is a lake which is actually the beating heart of this historical complex. The Takht-e-Suleyman lake is a calcium-rich spring with thousands of years of age, which outflows water rigorously from the deep underground water. The water, which boils at a depth of more than 120 meters, is saturated with minerals so that it cannot be used for drinking or farming. I am now in the area of Takht-e-Suleyman. It's really cold in here. I'd better wear my gloves. There is snow everywhere, and the scenery is really fascinating. I have to walk further to reach the lake. Thank you. spectacular. The amount of minerals in the lake is so much, so it is not possible to dive or even see through the depth of the lake. That is why they say there is secrets about this lake. And there are also local legends. There is a story which says, one Solomon struck his stick to the ground, and a spring started flowing and created the lake, which today is called Tacht-e Suleiman. And here there is a notice. Oh, well, I'm not wearing my glasses, so I have to get close to see what's written. It reads, no swimming. Of course, no one ever swims in such a freezing weather. Oh, well, what's this? Oh, God. It's a gravestone. This grave belongs to a person who has gone swimming in the lake and drowned. In this season, which sunlight reflects off the snow, steam rise off the lake. It's a really mysterious and enchanting scenery. I can't take my eyes off of these beauties. I'd like to stand here forever and stare at this foggy lake. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. A new U.S. administration has come to power, but accusations against Washington seem to be quite familiar. Again, the U.S. is being accused of interfering in a sovereign country. This time it is Russia, where some demonstrations have taken place protesting the arrest of opposition figure Alexei Navalny on his return from Germany. Moscow has pointed the finger at Washington and trying to fuel the flames of protests in Russia. This coming at a time that Moscow says it is ready to talk to the Biden administration about improving ties. Well, stay with us as we take a look at all of this on this debate. We're going to start it off in Moscow and talk to our correspondent on the ground there, Marina Kortanova. Marina, great to have you with us. Well, fill us in on this latest situation and the accusations by Moscow of U.S. interference.
So thousands in major cities of Russia yesterday joined protest in support not only of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny, but against impoverishment of the population in the country, lack of production and unemployment, disagreeing with the policy of the current authorities and against the irremovability of the latter, as well as inflation, failed youth and social policy. Some scuffles and detentions took place. As you know, Alexei Navalny is a Russian opposition leader who heads the Anti-Corruption Foundation. He films investigations. Two of the latter caused the greatest resonance in Russian society. Meanwhile, the day earlier, the U.S. Embassy Moscow posted detailed information on its website regarding the time and locations of the mass rallies. Russian presidential spokesman Dmitry Peskov has described these statements as interference in the country's domestic affairs. The U.S. Embassy claimed to monitor the protests across Russia and accused the Russian authorities of suppressing free speech and free assembly. Peskov said that it is hard to imagine if Russian embassy had reacted in such manner when the United States experienced civil unrest. Then it would have caused certain discomfort in Washington. He also said that he always feels like recommending counterparts to imagine themselves in such a situation. Earlier, Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs made a statement that such comprehensive information goes beyond the concern about the well-being of U.S. citizens in Russia and goes in line with Washington's provocative and dogmatic policy of encouraging protests in countries whose governments are seen by the United States as undesirable.
Okay.
Any attempt to provide such coverage regarding unauthorized rallies to be deemed as blatant interference in Russia's country's domestic affairs and will provoke an appropriate response.
Okay, Marina, that's good. Marina, thanks so much for that update on the situation. That's our correspondent in Moscow, Marina Kortanova. I'd like to welcome my first guest to the program, Don DeBar, activist and commentator out of New York. Don, always a pleasure to have you on. Well, Don, it just sounds like copy-paste. I mean, it seems like we've been there before. Your take on all of this and the possibility of U.S. Stirring up the flames there now in Russia.
Well, first of all, thank you, Marzi. A pleasure to be here with you. You know, the Russians with this Novichok poison, and if they wanted to do it right, they should come to the United States. You know, we have Monsanto. They never miss when you want to poison someone. They poison millions at a time. This is the first weekend after the new administration. For 4 years, I've been trying to point out to people and others as well that when we left off on January 19th, 2017, when the Obama administration left off, was with Russia surrounded by U.S. forces from the Baltics to the Korean Peninsula, under constant war games, diplomats being expelled, you know, by the handful, rhetoric that's started in mid, I would say, in 2014, and then in July of 2016 during the campaign, really aggressive, calling Russia every kind of evil and accusing it of attempting essentially to overthrow the government of the United States, which it was claimed by such as Clapper and others, head of CIA, DNI, FBI, that actually had occurred with Donald Trump, that Donald Trump was placed in office on January 20th, 2017 by Vladimir Putin, and that he was his puppet. We heard accusations on the editorial page of the New York Times when Trump met with Putin and didn't punch him in the face. That this was treason, he should be removed and tried, and you know there's death penalty for treason. So the first weekend after Biden takes office under this cloud, we have an uprising, quote unquote, of several thousand in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and a couple of smaller cities across Russia, coordinated, widely publicized, advanced warning, by the way, from the State Department to Americans traveling in Russia that this was going to happen. But the maximum expression of what looks like the beginning of an attempted color revolution in Russia by the United States. That happening on the first day of the Biden administration, when we were concerned that they might get aggressive with Russia and even stumble into a war, is frightening, to use the simple word.
All right. Well, let me welcome My next guest, out of London, Jonathan Fryer, author and broadcaster. Thanks so much for being with us, Jonathan. Well, you heard Don kick off the program and say basically we've picked up, it seems, from where the U.S. left off 4 years ago in dealing with Russia. Your take on all this, I mean, it appears very reminiscent of 2014 Ukraine, when the U.S. was exposed for its involvement in protests, and even American officials participated in demonstrations there, cursed the EU for not being on the same page. Your take on this, and why does it seem that Washington uses the same playbook time and time again in different countries?
Well, I tend to feel that it's actually a coincidence that this has happened at the first week of the Biden presidency. We have to remember that it was triggered by Alexei Navalny's return to Russia a few days ago, and then his arrest, and then the demonstrations that have taken place across Russia. I don't think this is an American-inspired counter-protest or color revolution, as Don put it. Mm-hmm. I think that, frankly, it's quite normal for the Americans to put out a release, as they did to their citizens, to say, avoid these places. There are going to be demonstrations. There will probably be arrests, as indeed there were well over 1,000 people picked up for what was described as unauthorized protests. But I think actually the climate for U.S.-Russian relations is actually got a boost by the arrival of Biden, who's a much more level-headed figure than Donald Trump ever was. And indeed, the Russians themselves, just over the last 48 hours or so, congratulated Joe Biden for suggesting prolonging the nuclear arms treaty for another 5 years and agreed that that would be a jolly good thing to do.
Well, what about that, Don? Because on the one hand, of course, we saw Trump or the Trump administration do some definitely off-the-wall things. But on the other hand, Trump continually wanted to have good relations with Moscow. But as you said, you pointed out that from the very beginning, he was told that the Russians had tried to interfere in the elections and that he was a spy. It just seemed to be this pull in not allowing that administration to establish closer ties. How do you see it?
First, behavior has in the context of votes in Congress. The first being the vote on sanctions, that sanctions bill that was proposed by Congress on its own initiative, adding sanctions against Russia, against Korea, and against Iran to the pile that had already existed, almost directly in response to Trump's pronouncements about Russia, that it would be good if the U.S. and Russia had better relations and not a bad thing. His actual movement towards relations and his visit ultimately to North Korea, and his failure to act on the aggressive rhetoric that he had tossed at Iran up to that point by passing a sanctions bill on the order of 517-6 or something, which is not only veto-proof but practically unanimous. That first vote telegraphed what policy was going to be, and the second one was the vote on his impeachment, which, you know, passed the House and was close enough in the Senate to be discouraging. He was looking at his foreign policy essentially being at the sufferance of Congress and his removal being an immediate tool that they would have available. And you can look at the speed by which that Ukrainian pause for his ultimate impeachment matured from the occurrence until the actual vote as you know, an indication of how tight a leash he was on. So on the one hand, even though the U.S. Continued to either allow nuclear treaties with Russia to expire and even further abrogated some or withdrew from some, a lot of the content that was actually happening around those had to do with obsolete treaties. For example, the treaty that dealt with cruise missiles was critical in the 1980s, but the technology is obsolete. You can have that treaty in place and still have 9 minutes or so from launch to demolition in Russia or the United States with the weapons that have been developed since. Trump's behavior was that he shut down the war games. That all by itself dropped the level of readiness of troops on both sides and the risk of accidental war, which is where I see the real risk of nuclear war coming, being accidental, but a consequence of, complete total criminal negligence on the part of the United States by forcing a level of hostilities where everything on air trigger.
Well, Jonathan, you said that you just thought that all of this is the timing was accidental. I mean, we look at Navalny's return to Russia. This is after accusing the government of being behind his poisoning. Do you not find it curious that he would return and that he would return at this time? And then we see these protests sprouting up in various cities?
No, I think it was a reasonable time to go back for him once he had recovered fully from the poisoning that he and the treatment that he underwent in Germany. So I don't find the timing strange for him to go back to Moscow at this stage. What is really interesting, though, is that whereas Alexei Navalny was very much a fringe figure a few years ago and not all that many people would have supported him, that situation has obviously changed. Because even though, obviously, Vladimir Putin decided that Navalny should not be allowed to contest the presidential election, nonetheless, Navalny has obviously got several thousand supporters. One can't accurately judge how many who've gone out knowing full well that if they did go out in an unauthorized protest, as they're called, they would be likely to get arrested, including his wife, of course, Yulia. So I don't think it's as sinister or as worrying as really one should feel. And I was encouraged by the fact that the Kremlin actually did say, having reprimanded the American embassy for putting out the detail of the route of one of the protests in Moscow, the Kremlin then did say what they hoped was that there would be new talks with Washington and that the way to solve problems is through negotiation. And that I absolutely endorse.
Well, let's talk about that, Don, actually what Jonathan has just said, that in the middle of all of this and seeing these demonstrations basically increase and feeling that the United States is behind him, at the same time, Russian officials have said that they would welcome talks with the Biden administration. Your assessment of that?
First of all, just put things in context. If there were kind of media support of the protests that took place in, well, let's even back up. Let's go to the period, say, from December 12th until January 6th, just prior to when the Electoral College met, up until the time that the joint session of Congress took place and the so-called attempted coup, when the guy with the horns and 100 of his friends stormed the Capitol with flags and urine and balloons or whatever else they had. If there were analogous support for that from Russian media to the American audience, to that which has been beamed at the Russian audience in support of Navalny through this entire episode, and any other opposition figure that could be found, you would have a tremendous outcry from the U.S. government that this was constituted, someone like the senator from New Hampshire, for example, that this constitutes an act of war, Gene Shinin. The scale of activity in the United States that provokes another Patriot Act, essentially. 100 people storm the gates of the Capitol and do nothing, really, other than get shot. One of them beats a cop to death. But, this is something that is blown out of proportion, as if you know, we were under threat of being taken over by a foreign power. Meanwhile, the support that's given to this, there are parades on behalf of the Communist Party, which gets a third of the vote in every election in Russia, that never make the air in the United States, let alone make Russian air via U.S. media. This is the context for it. What's going on is an attempt by U.S. intelligence agencies to pressure the Russian government with the threat of a color revolution. That's how it's seen in Russia, although the threat is not seen as much as Langley would like it to be, because Navalny really is still a fringe character, and that whatever he represents still has essentially a fringe following. But the attempt has already been made, and the first shot fired over the bow that, okay, this is a new sheriff in town, and we're coming in for the things we want.
Okay.
It's already been told what they want: the oil, they want the gas, they want no competition on the global stage. And this is the first step. And they've already said more of this next week and the week after.
Well, Jonathan, in your perspective, how likely are we to see warmer relations between the U.S. and Russia now during this Biden administration?
I think we can be cautiously optimistic. I don't think we're going to see a great love-in between Washington and Moscow, but I do think the general tenor of Joe Biden's administration, assuming that it's going to be confirmed by the Senate, will be to have friendly relations with Russia, with some other countries around the world that are important in the world economy, and of course with the European Union in particular, which is a slight divergence from Donald Trump's priorities. I think also that we're seeing that Joe Biden very much wants to get away from this idea of America being isolated, being in difficult arrangements with other countries that are not suitable, not conducive to peace. And so I'm cautiously optimistic, but I don't think we should go over the top on this. I don't think we should say that we're ushering in a great new era of friendship. I think it's looking good.
Well, even if you, just staying with you, Jonathan, when we look at some of the remarks actually that Don made, and referring to the last administration of Obama, and he said it feels as if we've picked up from where we had left off. Your assessment of that, because if we look at the Democrats in general, what we saw and reaction by the Democrats and others towards Trump and saying that he wanted warmer relations with Moscow, it appears that the Democrats are actually the ones that have been against the warming of this relationship. And if we look at some of the individuals who are going to be serving in the cabinet, whether we're talking about Nuland or others, not a great track record when it comes to Russian affairs.
Well, certainly several of the people who are proposed for the new cabinet are indeed familiar faces from before Donald Trump's time. And of course, Biden was vice president to President Obama, so we maybe shouldn't be surprised by that continuity. So in that sense, yes, we've gone back to a certain period where of people who have the experience of those years. But I do think that nonetheless, the world atmosphere has changed over the last 4 years, and that although Donald Trump said that he wished to improve relations with Moscow, and that he said that he was going to get a nuclear deal with North Korea, which he didn't despite his high-profile summits, I think we have a recognized situation now where we'll go back to more of a world order in which there are more balanced decisions being taken. And I don't think that Joe Biden himself will want to say anything or do anything that would antagonize Moscow at the moment. We all accept Vladimir Putin is there, and so long as he wants to be there, he's going to remain there. So that it would be ridiculous for any outside power, including the United States, to try to urge people to get rid of him, because they won't. He still has an enormous amount of support.
Okay. Well, Don, can the U.S. in your perspective, establish mutual relations with countries and treat them as equals. Is this possible in your perspective?
I mean, it's always possible. Is it possible with the current leadership? I don't know. We have to look at the context under which this administration comes to power and how the other one was driven from power. And the primary disagreement between those factions of whatever power elite exists here that was involved in it is over two different worldviews. One that Trump saw more as a multilateral view, where the players all have their own agency, and they're expected to pay their own way, too, by the way. Now, the disagreement, quote-unquote, with the European countries, for example, was actually a disagreement with that part of the European elites that have the Atlanticist point of view, the international view, with the U.S. as a global hegemon and everyone having a respective place as a higher or lower level vassal. The view that Trump had was one more of multilateral, and the view that was in power for a long time since World War II, particularly since 1991, the fall of the USSR, was the hegemonic one. The hegemonic one is now back in power. Where does that leave Russia? It leaves Russia to do what it's told, shut up and sit down, or else. It's like the rest of the world. And unfortunately, I think Russia made a decision a long time ago, certainly since it got control of itself again when Putin came into office, that the last time they were going to allow that to happen was with Operation Barbarossa, that they weren't going to allow anyone to come in and kill 20 or 30 or 40 million Russians again without taking a lot of people out at the head end. And so as they push more aggressively against Russia, and again, I'll remind that what they were doing essentially...
20 seconds, Don.
...wargaming from the Baltics to Korea. Wargame means you start an invasion and stop at the border. The other country has to put its defenses in motion. Well, if you do that and the other country thinks you're coming in and both sides have nuclear war, I don't know another scenario for the end of humanity, but that seems to be about as close as we've mustered so far.
Okay. An unfortunate note to end, but we're out of time. I appreciate both of you being with us. Don DeBar, activist and commentator out of New York, and out of London, Jonathan Fryer, author and broadcaster. And thank you so much for being with us on Another Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
The recent events in France and similar ones in some other Western countries have convinced me to directly talk to you about them. A letter for you.
And this is a letter written by the leader of the Muslim Ummah.
Special program on the message of Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei to the youth in Europe and North America.
Open the windows! Let the world hear!
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. Dear listeners, I am Muzaffar Abbas Haider.
I am Murtaza Rezavi.
And I am Ali Shah.
A recent letter from Ayatollah Khamenei has been published to the web, and it's causing some controversy. People are thinking about it. People are contemplating about
it. That was the aim.
And inshallah, we today are going to be talking about it. So, we're going to hand it over straight away to Irtaza with a statement. And you're going to tell me whether you agree or disagree with it.
I agree.
Hatred between West and East. By the way, this is not from the letter. This is a statement which I heard recently from a friend. Hatred between West and East has reached its peak. It is the same between Islam and Christianity, between the Muslim world and the West. What's your thoughts on that statement?
I don't see no problem between Islam and Christianity, and also the East. It's not really East and the West. I mean, it's one world. There's no real. Mm-hmm. I don't see no East and West, to be honest with you. Like,
there's good things in both sides of the world. But then, what about Islam and Christianity? Would you say that there's a peaked hatred between the two religions?
If anything, and this is specifically to London.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen reverends and sheikhs. Sheikhs are the Islamic preachers.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen them come together and work together, to be honest with you.
Mm.
I've seen them come more closer. Because under one factor, under one roof of faith,
mm-hmm.
mannerism and like etiquettes and stuff, they come underneath this type of branch. They have Jesus as the Son of God. We have Jesus as the Prophet of God.
See, throughout history, we've seen this kind of conflict between Islam and Christianity. We've seen the Crusades. We've seen the slave trade, where many of the slaves who were brought into America from Africa and other parts of Europe were actually Muslim.
Okay.
You know? And there's actually historical records of slaves being seen worshipping or bowing down towards the sun during sunrise. And obviously people observing this thought that they were worshipping the sun, but they were actually Muslims. They were praying Fajr prayers.
Okay, first time I heard that.
Yeah, yeah. Now, this shows that there has always been this conflict between Christianity and Islam, or the East and the West. Now, like, more war in the world now than there ever has been before.
Well, there's been more war in the world. I mean, we're not in a world war yet. There was two world wars that have been. One nuclear bomb was already thrown over Hiroshima
mm-hmm.
by the Americans. That's already done. Mm-hmm. So, like, I would say there's more atrocities in terms of, like, because media has risen, because
mm-hmm.
media is so easy. Like, so easy. You see something on the street, film it, chuck it on YouTube. Yeah. I would say it's easier in terms of that. Uh-huh. But in terms of war has risen, I'm not really sure about that. And the thing with Christianity and Islam...
Now, the reason I've started with this statement is because this is a typical kind of statement which is thrown around in the West by extremist groups who have a hatred towards Islam. They'll say things like, the Muslims have come and we need to start a crusade against them.
Hmm.
They'll say things like, we're overwhelmed by Muslims. There's more Muslims than us our own country.
This is the sad thing. Because of stuff like this, because of ignorant people like this, on both sides of the scale, whether you're Muslim, Jew, Christian, whatever you are, even believe in Nirvana, whatever you are, but if you cause a war because of this, this is where the other people, intellectuals to an extent, if I can give them this honour, they turn around and say, wars are always started because of religion.
Because of religion, yeah.
This is where they come and with that blanket statement as well. But if you ask me personally, no, I don't think the war between Christianity and Islam is okay, fine, if you want to say they're at war, I could understand that, but to come and say they're at a peak, that's a completely different level. I don't agree with that.
Ali, Irtaza said that he believes that Islam and Christianity are at war. Would you agree with that?
I believe that they hate each other. Islam and Christianity hate each other.
Irtaza, back to you.
Yeah.
Why do you think that? I don't think they hate each other at all.
I think they hate each other, bro.
Why?
Because
Christianity doesn't preach hatred. And to be honest with you, neither does Islam. Islam preaches defense.
Why do you think most of the politicians in the world, in the West, are against Islam?
Politics is a complete different thing. Politics is very slimy, to be honest with you. Very slimy.
They want a one rule around the whole world, one rule order. And they only want one religion. They don't care about the other religion. Like,
politicians.
For example, Obama. Yeah.
Okay.
He wants a one rule.
Yeah.
Like, you know what's going on with the Illuminati and stuff, right? I will say one thing is that they hate Islam because they want everyone to believe their views, their religion. And if you're not going to agree, or if you're not going to believe, they're going to be our enemy.
It's not a hatred to Islam. It's more, whoever's in my way, better get out of my way.
Well, not really. You know why?
It's not Islam. It's not Christianity.
Brother,
it's not Judaism. Not Buddhism. It's nothing. It's not even weed. It's nothing. It's just, if you're in my way, I hate you. That's what it is. It's like, if you're in my way, I hate you. Nothing more and nothing less than that.
The West right now, who are they fighting with the most?
Right now, it's Islam.
It's Islam.
But like we discussed earlier, like, it's been slavery, black people. Before that, Jews, the Holocaust, and so on and so forth. All this stuff. It's always been a target, people. It's been communism. It's been Russia.
I think it's only towards the Islam, because they just want to kill every Muslim.
They
want to get rid of all the Muslims in the East.
I think they want you to understand their version of Islam.
All right, now, you've talked about this kind of... Since we've opened Pandora's box and we've talked about these people who are running things behind government, who are the people who supposedly actually do run government, not the people who you see, not the presidents, not the officials, etc., but the people who are in the shadows.
And I'll give you the reason for this. because Islam is a big threat for the West. Now, and that's the only reason they want to get rid of
the
Muslims.
This is the point that Ali is making, and I really do want to focus on this, because in the letter, and I don't want to make a connection, but I do want to sort of ask if there is a connection to what Ali is saying and what the letter of Ayatollah Khamenei is saying. Because in the letter he says, "You know well that humiliation and spreading hatred and illusionary fear of the other